When working in an archive, you sometimes encounter collections so immense that they are hard to comprehend. The Prize Papers is one such collection, consisting of objects and papers confiscated from ships captured by the British between 1652 and 1815. The Prize Papers collection is so vast that it remained unexamined for years. However, we are now finally making progress on it. The work is expected to take a full team of people 20 years to complete. While we don't have that much time today, we are dedicating 3 episodes of our podcast to this topic. I'm Chloe Lee, Empire and Commonwealth Records Specialist here at the National Archives. I also host our podcast, On the Record at the National Archives, where we uncover the past through stories of everyday people. The contents of the prize papers reveal the experiences of everyday people during the Age of Sail, as well as the conduct of global trade and warfare at sea. In the first episode of our mini-series on the prize papers for On the Record, I want to delve into some of the fascinating items. My colleagues here at the National Archives, in collaboration with a team from the University of Oldenburg in Germany, are on a mission to locate, catalogue and digitise these items. This includes around 500,000 letters, papers and artefacts. They have 4,088 boxes to examine, and some of them are in front of me right now. Yes, I'm standing in a special room at the National Archives next to my colleague, Oliver Finnegan, who is a prize papers record specialist here at the National Archives. Oliver, look at all of this stuff. Can you talk to me a bit about what we've set out today?
I can. Hi, Chloe. I've been doing some serious digging to find what we've got here
today. Some serious digging. And we've got various papers across the table. Oh, some yellowing papers. I can see handwriting. I can see some seals. And right here in front of me, I have a box. So am I allowed to open it, Oliver?
You are, yeah.
Okay.
Just have an open and see what you find inside.
Okay, listeners. So I'm going to open the box now. Okay, I'm going to put the lid here. Oh, okay, right. So
I can smell it.
So what can I smell? Okay, so it's a little bit mildewy, and I can see, is it like sackcloth on the very top?
Yeah.
It looks like some kind of characters, maybe on the front of it. To me, they look like they could be Chinese characters, actually. Mm. And then also some little bits of red, kind of crumbly. Me, I think that there maybe are some type of seal.
It's wax, yeah.
It's wax.
It's red wax.
Okay.
Lift it out and see what you think it is.
Okay. Oh, I kind of don't want to touch it.
It's okay.
It's going to get me dusty. Okay, it's not fragile. Okay, so it's some kind of sackcloth. I'm going to just move it around the table, maybe place it down. Okay, so I am unfolding it. Wow, okay, so I've spread it out on the table now. It's probably about the size of an A3 piece of paper. It's kind of brown. You can see where maybe some of it has been exposed to the light. And yeah, it looks like some kind of... Okay, so it's not a Chinese character. It looks to me like a small crown that has been like a mark on the front. Mm. And then maybe a big piece of lettering. Can you give me any clues, Oliver?
So it is just a crown, and then it's got a kind of pen flourish as you go down that somebody's written on it. I'm not quite sure what that signifies, but the outline you can see is where there were papers.
I see.
So it would have been folded like that. What you're actually looking at is a post bag.
A post bag.
So this is a post bag from about 1807.
Ooh, and a post bag, so it would have contained letters, notes?
Yes, yeah, so everything else that's in the box that you see was contained within that post bag.
Wow. Okay. So there's a lot of material in this box, folks. I've got a big, almost bound book as well. Again, it's about the size, maybe a little bit smaller than the sack. And again, it looks like there's some writing on the front.
Can you read it?
It's in Danish.
A journal book for the ship Hercules.
And it says 1807 on it.
The year 1807.
And then yes. C-O...
I think that's the name of the captain.
The name of the captain.
Yeah.
And then 2856. What is this number about?
The number would have been allocated when it after it came into the archive.
I see. So I'm right to assume that this is just one of the over 4,000 boxes. Can you tell us a bit more about that collection?
Yeah, so this, you're right, is one of the boxes that we're working with. But this is actually a box that we haven't got to yet and we haven't worked through. We haven't catalogued, we haven't put into any order. So when you actually look inside, you can see that it's just an enormous explosion of papers.
So it does just look like someone's messy loft box, basically.
Like a drawer where you shove all of your unwanted correspondence. You know, that
and you can't be bothered to sort it.
Exactly.
It's giving you anxiety.
Yeah, the things that you haven't filed.
Does this box give you some anxiety, Oliver?
Yeah, I find this box very relatable.
Okay.
You know? So you'll see when you actually get looking, we're just going to haul it out the box.
Okay. It's quite weighty.
Yeah, it is. It's heavy because it's a lot of paper.
Okay.
We'll take that as well. So it's papers in all different kinds of language. Some of it's in French, some of it's in Danish, some of it's in Spanish. And these all come from the island of St. Thomas in the Caribbean. So they were on a ship.
So they traveled a long way on the ship that was captured by the British.
Right. So they were all in this post bag on a ship.
Okay.
That was coming from the Danish Caribbean at the time. And you see the enormous range of material that we have in the prize papers here. You can see that you have things like logbooks, like we looked at, letters that were sent as post, because virtually everything that was in here was in this post bag. It was being sent from the Caribbean
to
Europe.
And you say Danish Caribbean, because at the time that the island that we're talking about was a colony of Denmark.
At the time, yes, exactly. So St. Thomas. And yes, just a huge range of material. You get a lot that's papers from ships, so you even get things like receipts. And one of the most unusual things about this as a collection is that it's not the normal kinds of papers that would have been survived or would have gone through the process of archival selection in different ways.
I see. So it's kind of unmediated, these boxes.
Exactly. Unmediated is a really good word because it is the papers from a ship that have been scooped up, taken, put into our archive, where they've sat in these boxes for many, many years without really being consulted, without really being described in any kind of catalogue as to what they are.
And it's a post bag, so it's containing letters from people just saying hello to friends?
Personal letters of any kind.
I see.
Commercial letters. Anything that could be on a ship, we can have in this collection. Because ships in this period, you know, they were a very different kind of technology. They were transport, they were a postal system,
they were a means of warfare.
They were a home.
I see.
In a way that ships aren't now.
So how did they get here?
So the reason that they're here is a quirk of pre-modern warfare, effectively. So during wars between the different European powers from about the 16th century through until the mid-19th century, it was very common practice to do something called prize taking. You could also call it commerce raiding, which is when private ships owned by merchants and also naval ships would be permitted by different European powers to seize the shipping of enemies. So if Britain and France were at war, British, and they call them privateers, private ships that are licensed by the state to capture enemy shipping, or naval vessels, would be able to go out and capture French ships. And when they seized them, to determine that the seizure was legal, there would be a court process. So there was a court which was part of the High Court of Admiralty that was called a prize court that adjudicated the captures. It determined if they were legal, they were legitimate.
And these are all the papers of legal captures then?
So these are evidence in a court case.
I see. So that's the provenance of how they got into the archive.
Yeah, so the reason they're in a state archive is because they are part of a court process. But they are unusually personal for something that you would get in an archive like ours, which is a state archive. So that's the reason why we have them. Vast amounts were brought in as evidence. So what would happen is once a ship was captured, say if it was captured and brought into England during a war in this period, kind of, you know, about 1650s to around the mid-19th century, they would be taken off the ship by the captors, so the privateer's crew, bundled up, and then they would be sent to London And then there, the court would rule on whether the capture was legal.
I see.
And we don't really know why, but after the case, the court kept the papers because prize courts exist in other European countries as well. We haven't fully investigated it, but a lot of others, they didn't seem to have retained the papers, so it does seem to be a relatively unique set of material.
So how many ships were captured?
We think that for what we have in our collection, there are papers from about 35,000 ships.
Wow.
So in some periods of warfare, they were capturing hundreds, if not thousands, of ships each year.
Wow.
So they can come from anywhere in the world as well. That's something that's worth bearing in mind. It's in all different kinds of languages because it's ships that the British seize. And the British went to war with a lot of people in the 17th and the 18th and the 19th
and
centuries.
So it really helps us to paint a global picture. I mean, I can see that there's lots of letters here. What else is represented in the collection?
So you can find all sorts of material. You can find literally the contents of sailors' pockets. So you can find materials that they were using to just write on, do calculations.
So like we can get an understanding of people's leisure time aboard.
Exactly, yes.
I see.
And then papers that belong to captains, ship's logs, account books. Sometimes you find poetry, people's laundry lists.
And we're going to be looking at a bit of that now, I guess. Okay, so I've just opened something that was a little wrapped bundle, and inside it looks like we have a little key.
It's not really clear what the key is for. We find them sometimes in the collection, but it's just an example of the sort of detritus that was on the ship.
So you get objects as well, not just written things. Okay, so, I mean, you said that vast number of ships, the vast number of boxes, just one, and even in this box, so much material contained. How do we think through a collection that vast?
Well, a good place to start is to think about one capture. So what I suggest is we start talking about a very particular ship, which is one of my favorites in the collection, which I've worked with a huge amount over the years, which is called the Franciscus of Hamburg.
So tell me the story of the capture of the Franciscus.
So it began in May of 1744.
Okay.
In Tenerife, so the port of La Orotava.
Okay, so we're thinking balmy. It's balmy out.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly, yeah. It definitely would be at that time of the year.
Okay.
Beautiful sunshine. And then the ship was gradually being loaded in the harbor of La Orotava by a bunch of sailors who were under the command of a guy called Christian Lorentzen.
So it's
German.
Noisy. So he's a German captain, noisy.
Yep.
I'm assuming that they're loading the ship with foodstuffs as well as...
It would have been provisions. They would have had food. They would have had alcohol
of
different kinds. But what they were really loading the ship with that was the purpose of the voyage was they were loading wine from the Canary Islands, but they were also loading something called logwood, which comes from the Yucatan Peninsula predominantly in Mexico. And also dollars, otherwise known as pieces of eight.
Would they be loading currency onto the ship?
It would be used to buy other goods.
Okay.
So it's Spanish currency is the most stable form of currency in the period.
I see.
That's used in the way that American dollars are in financial systems today.
So there's no conversion. You have to take your money with you. You have to take all your things
silver
with
dollars.
You.
Yep.
Silver dollars. Okay.
So you would take those. So
heavy,
those would have
heavy,
been
right?
Very much so,
okay.
Yes. And there was a huge amount of money that was put on the ship. I mean, the ship itself was about 180 tons. Huge sails that would have been needed to carry it. It would have had a very large hull to carry cargo mostly, but it probably wouldn't have had that many sailors on it. So it probably would have had about 10 or 12.
Okay, so fairly small
sailors.
Crew to look after all of that stuff.
Yes.
And all of that alcohol.
Exactly. I'm sure they'd be able to get rid of a lot of it.
Dip in a bit.
Yeah. So, but really the cargo that the ship had was symbolic of the place of the Canary Islands, so in Tenerife in particular, within European and American sort of transatlantic trading systems, which was, it was carrying local wine, but it was also carrying a lot of produce that came from the Spanish Empire.
I see.
So you've got logwood, which was used to make blue and purple dyes. It's very popular across Europe. And also the money, most of which would have been mined at a single mine in Peru called Potosi, where the silver itself was mined under horrendous conditions by unfree laborers.
So these are enslaved people digging
some
out
some would have
that
been
material.
Enslaved, different other forms of indigenous labor systems that were adopted by the Spanish to used for the purpose of extracting silver from the mine.
And the Canary Islands is colonized by European power at this time?
By the Spanish.
I I see.
Relatively early, okay. Prior to the first voyage to the Americas.
Okay, so they're loading the ship, lots of different kind of stuff aboard, a small skeleton crew, and they're making their way out into the open ocean?
So yes, they leave, I think it's on the 20th of May, from Tenerife, and their destination is Hamburg, which is where the ship's originally based. It's got two German merchants who are resident in Hamburg, who are the ship's owners. And it sort of makes its way along the Atlantic seaboard of Europe over the next several weeks.
Okay.
The voyage was a difficult one because it was in the middle of something called the War of Austrian Succession, which lasted from roughly 1740 to 1748.
So fairly troubled waters they're navigating.
Exactly. Okay. And the ship has a particular problem, which is that it's a neutral ship. Hamburg's not involved in the war.
I see.
But it's carrying goods that belong to people who lived on both sides of that war.
Hmm.
So it has goods that are put on board. Some of the dollars and things like that and the logwood were put on by French merchants, some by Irish merchants, some by German merchants, because Britain and France are at war. If they get stopped by French or by British privateers or naval vessels, then they might get seized.
And so that was quite a common practice at the time. Our German captain, was he the rule or?
He was, yeah. So neutral trade is a huge phenomenon. It's used to get around the trading restrictions between the different countries during the war. So everybody starts trading into the neutral ports.
So you're a bit of a chancer if you're doing that this time.
Yes, and this definitely was. Because there was that huge risk of being doubly captured. Quite often a neutral ship will only have investors from one side of a war, but this one they had both.
Okay, it was very so you'd be risky. Captured by either side.
Yes, and it was a very valuable ship because it was carrying money, which is probably about the most valuable cargo you can have.
So at what point do they get captured?
So they actually get captured twice. It's quite an unfortunate episode for them, which is they get to the coast of Brittany in mid-June.
So not too far off.
No, so they're pretty close to getting to Hamburg. They're pretty close. And then they get stopped by an entire French naval squadron.
So no chance of escape.
So there's no way they were going to escape or even really argue with it. They weren't going to try and put up a fight because some people did. But the ship stops them and the French sailors started rummaging through the papers on the ship, searching for evidence that they were carrying
British
cargo. Which is some of the evidence that's in front of us here.
I see.
But while they were busy doing that, the admiral of the French fleet got a letter saying that he had to leave and go to the Caribbean immediately. So they gave up the ship. They couldn't be bothered to try and take it. Too much work. And then so
they let the Franciscus go?
So they let it go.
With all the things still aboard?
With everything aboard, having rummaged through all of the papers.
Bit of a mess.
Huge mess. Broken open all the chests, everything else. But it was something like 3 days later, they were off the coast of Kent and they got stopped by a British privateer. And when they saw the British privateer was about to stop them, they started trying to frantically hide all of the papers that were on the ship that showed that they had anything aboard that was French.
So what are they doing? Putting it into any spaces available
hid some under the casks of wine.
I see.
They hid some in buoys that were on the ship. They hid some under a cannon. They really tried to stash it frantically, but it didn't work.
And so the British come aboard, they start rifling through, they find all this evidence, they capture the ship.
Exactly. So they took the ship into Dover.
Mm-hmm.
And then the papers were all scooped up and sent into London to the High Court of Admiralty.
Okay.
Which is why we now have them. But they're in a huge state of disarray when we found them, precisely because nobody really touched them and they were brought in a mess. So.
And they'd been gone through twice.
Exactly.
Once by the French and then by the British. Okay.
Yep.
Okay, so that's the kind of story, I guess, of some of the ships and some of the material that we have out in front of us today. Can you talk me through what we've got on the table in front of us now?
So what we're looking at here is an example of what we usually call mail in transit, otherwise known as post.
Okay.
So this is
things that would have been in that post bag that we looked at earlier, right?
So it would have been exactly in a bag like that. The way that post usually worked in this period is they put up a sack like the one we looked at in a tavern with the destination written on it. and people would pay money and slip the letters into the sack.
Oh, okay. Like a kind of mobile post box.
Exactly.
At the pub.
Exactly. Sometimes if you go to the post office today, you see them doing similar things behind the counter where they
in
have
big sacks.
Sack hung up mm-hmm, with its destination. Mm-hmm. So yes, there's about 6 bundles of letters in here that were intended for delivery. Not just
and these letters, sorry, where are they going?
So they all come from Tenerife. Mm-hmm. And they're all intended for Dunkirk, Hamburg, and London, because you get them going into other ports and the letters being going for onward delivery.
So this is a really wide picture of letter writing at the period, going to different destinations. I mean, we have 3 piles of letters in front of us, I can see here. And you know, the papers are maybe a bit smaller than your A4, maybe kind of slightly bigger than A5. Some of them have folds. Some of them have these red waxy seals with maybe insignia on or letters, and then really big cursive handwriting. I mean, these people are writing long letters to each other.
Yeah. And you can see that they've been completely flattened, which is different from their original condition, but so, they would have been folded up.
Oh, okay, so like there's no envelopes in this time.
No, the letters, well, sometimes there are, but you have to make your own.
Complicated and expensive.
Yeah, so it's just uses extra paper. So usually you just fold up the letter in a certain way to see it, to make it square, and then you would seal it, and the seal itself would probably be your personal seal. This is one example of the sorts of letters that you get in the Franciscus, but also in prize papers in general, mm-hmm. which is these are 3 letters that were sent from a man called William Farrell. Here we have a really fantastic example of the kinds of letters that you can get in the prize papers collection.
So you've cherry-picked this for us today.
Very carefully, yes.
Okay.
From within all of the mass of papers. So these are in English,
okay.
Thankfully, which means that we can sort of look at them relatively easily here. So all 3 letters are sent from the same person. So they're sent from a man called William Farrell, mm-hmm. who moved to the Canary Islands in 1740. Mm-hmm. And who he was writing to were his family members who lived in Ireland. So they all lived in and around Waterford. They were a relatively wealthy family. They were landowners. They were a gentry family. But William Farrell had moved abroad to the Canary Islands, where he was apprenticed to a merchant.
So who are these letters to?
So you can see on the back uh-huh. who they're addressed to. So this one is to, actually it says to a bookkeeper called Maurice Hearn.
For Maurice O'Hearn, I can see in really big cursive handwriting, some big fancy H's and M's.
And he was actually his cousin. So this is to William Farrell's cousin. The other 2 letters are to his mother and to his father and mother together.
So a really personal, intimate portrait of domestic relationships across a global kind of world at the time.
You would think so, but he's doing a thing that we've all done with our parents at some point in our lives, which he's asking them for money.
Okay, so, William. So can you give me an example of one of these escapades of William's?
Well, in this letter, there's a fantastic example. This is to his cousin, James Wise.
I've met with a great many ups and downs and had considerable losses and disappointments, all of which I received from the hand of God. With the Christian conformity I was capable of, and with great reason, for by his divine providence, I just escaped being lost on the Barbary coast, and another time from being murdered in the port of Orotava by a townsman and pretended relation of ours, one William Hayes, a periwig maker, whom stabbed me maliciously in the street at night with a sword of 3 files and wounded me in a degree in the left shoulder that I had liked to bleed to death in the same spot.
I mean, poor William, what a story. I can see we've got other letters here. Can you talk me through some of those?
Yeah, so we're looking at a separate bundle of letters here, actually. They're sent from Tenerife to Catherine Russell, who was studying at a convent near Dunkirk.
So she's the receiver of the letters.
Yes. So she was from an English Catholic family.
Okay.
Because Catholicism was still effectively outlawed in England at the time.
Okay.
So it's there, you get English merchants that are resident in Catholic countries, and they're drawn to places like Tenerife for the same reason that Farrell would have been, which is that it's a commercial hub where you can find work. It can be quite speculative. You can find a lot of connections there.
A real melting pot, effectively.
Exactly. So there were some of the English Catholic merchants that were resident there, and she was sent off to be educated. And the letters really are all from all different members of her family. So there's some from her brother, some from her father, some from her mother. And these are something that you would expect to be quite sort of tender, but they're really full of sort of stern admonishments to study
to her.
To study carefully. Because I think part of it,
I mean, there's lots of different handwriting I can see represented in these bundles. They're all about the same size, but they're all tied together.
Exactly. You see there written Sister Catherine Russell. This is from her brother. And it's a really good example of what we're talking about. He doesn't really say, we miss you, we'd like to see you.
There's not any of that intimacy.
No, it's very much the family's reputation depends upon
you
studying well here.
Wow,
and you
a lot of responsibility.
Keeping our reputation well. Exactly. There are some more some notes in it which are more sort of you would expect from a family, where they send her things from the island as presents.
I see.
I think they send her lemons, sugar sculptures.
Sugar
for some reason.
And they survived the journey, sugar sculptures.
Well, they didn't because the ship got captured, so I don't really know what happened to the sugar sculptures.
So they were kept as evidence, were they?
Yes, I'm sure.
So what does Peter admonish her for then?
He doesn't really admonish her. This is what he says.
Consider what a shame it will be to the hereafter should you neglect your studies. As everyone knows what accomplished ladies have come from thence, the Dunkirk convent, and this ought to be a sufficient motive for you not to give room to be reproached with the hard censure. For that you went to Flanders? Therefore, my dear sister, let me entreat you to mind your learning with cheerfulness, your music with spirit, and your dancing with grace, and by which, with good behaviour, you may agreeably tell where you were brought up.
This is written in 1744.
So it really feels like a gender stereotype that we see replicated in kind of TV and film, really, that kind of... Yes, educated, pious woman figure that Peter's really encouraging her to be. Okay, so we've looked at some of the letters that were meant for Catherine, maybe never got there. Well, didn't ever get there. What about this letter here? I can see right on top of this pile.
So this letter here is in Spanish. So there's several just like it. You can see it's written in a way that the lines aren't necessarily straight. It's probably from somebody who is slightly less literate than the people we've just been looking at.
Yes, some of the letters are more standardized. The kind of handwriting is neater. And then this feels a little bit more messy, a little bit more thrown together. And the ink is slightly lighter.
Yep. So these are all from a set of nuns that lived in a convent near Santa Cruz in Tenerife. Spanish nuns, although some of them, their names suggest that they were originally born in Ireland, but they're writing in Spanish. And what they're doing in these letters is they're writing to a group of friars in Dunkirk.
Right.
Who were part of the same religious order, so the Dominicans.
So these are like pen pals.
Exactly. That's exactly what they're like. So they are sending gifts backwards and forwards. In this particular letter here, the nun thanks the friar who sent her presents previously. Apparently, he'd sent her a new habit. And in return, she sends him boxes, which are apparently from all of the nuns, which contain 34 pounds of fine chocolates.
Wow.
And another box full of.
That's a great gift.
Exactly. And a box full of flowers.
Okay, lovely. So, through the prize papers, how can we learn about global trade at the time?
One of the best ways that you can find out about it is that the ships themselves, we've dealt with a lot of personal correspondence letters that were on the ship, but they also carried a lot of what we call ship's papers.
Mm-hmm.
So these are administrative paperwork that you had to fill out in ports or agreements between merchants that were on the ship when they were captured. And they can really show you all kinds of things, how much goods were being moved, from where, who possessed the goods. And there's a lot of interesting sort of physical processes and practices that went on within the trade itself. So if we start over here, we can see that this here is something called a bill of lading. You still get these today.
Okay, so what Oliver's passed me now is like a small bundle, and it almost looks like little slips of paper.
Mm.
So are these like receipts? Some of it is like printed, and then some of it it's like a form.
Exactly, it's a form that you would fill out. And it just simply says, I, this person, whoever you are, I put onto this ship these goods, and they're owned by this person when they arrive, and they're consigned to that person.
I see. So it's like a record of ownership or
exactly
as it passes through different people.
So it's a very typical kind of document. We find a lot of them. And you'll see from here, we've got them as blank forms as well, so that you can just, that's how they would have been filled out. You would have cut them out.
Okay, and this is all in different languages as well.
Yeah.
I can see a bit of German here, I think.
Yeah, you would fill them out in lots of different languages, depending upon what was the most useful one for the situation.
Yeah.
So they would basically fill out two of these, the person who is sending them. The sender would retain one, the second one would go on the ship with the goods. Mm-hmm. And then the bill of lading would be on the ship with, say, a barrel or set of chests, and the barrels would be marked with what's called a merchant mark, which is also, and then that same mark, which you can see here, is put onto the bill of lading.
So, for example, if you aborted a ship to capture that ship, you should be able to identify from this paperwork and the mark who belonged to who, where it was going, and where those goods originated from.
Exactly. And if you're a sailor who can't necessarily read or write that well, then perhaps you can match the mark to the barrels yourself when you're unloading it. And then when the ship's unloaded, then the recipient would get the second copy of the bill of lading from the ship, plus the goods, and then both sides have a copy. And it's a practice that goes back into the medieval period, bills of lading. But when you get print, it's much easier to do this, because just in the past, they just had
to do a note.
Handwrite it. Yeah, so that's one form. The others you get are all kinds of odds and ends. Like this here is just a list of the food that was on the ship. So a lot of meat, a lot of beer that the sailors would have eaten as they went.
And I can see here, so this is kind of broadly a bit of a table, but without the lines, right?
Yeah.
And here on the far left of this sheet of, I guess, closest to kind of A4 size, fairly ragged at the edges. And these are the marks right down the side.
Yeah, those are for a separate set of cargo.
Okay.
So those are different packs. So this is pack one, pack two.
Like a star here almost.
So the star is a Star of David, so that would be a Jewish merchant.
And then this almost looks like three circles with a little wavy line underneath.
Yeah.
Almost like a club, like on a card. And then some letters.
They would create their own merchant mark, and it would be unique to you, and it would go onto everything.
And so this list, beer, what else have we got represented on this list? Because
mostly food. This other things here, so that's the provisions on this right-hand side. And on the left-hand side, it simply says, oh yeah, this person has pack number two, pack number three, pack number six. So this is something that somebody's written out when they were trying to work out what belonged to who, probably with reference to the bills of lading.
So moving on, what else have we got about to maybe tell us about the people that were making these lists?
So we get a lot that's in the prize papers that comes from sailors themselves or passengers or anybody who happened to be on the ship. So you get letters that happen to be on the ship, you get the paperwork that corresponds to the ship and international trade, and then you get the material that belonged to the seafarers themselves, and that's what we're looking at here. So everything in front of us, it's odd scraps of paper and notebooks, they were all taken from the chests of the sailors on the ship when it was captured.
So they're personal belongings. So
exactly.
I can see it looks like sheet music here, written out with ink, and then this tiny little note kind of bound notebook, and it kind of, well, not notebook, it's printed, and it says is that an almanac?
It's almanac, yeah. So almanacs would have been were released annually. There's something that we don't necessarily have so much nowadays, but they were very common in the past, and they contain all kinds of useful information. You see, this one's very small, isn't it?
It's like pocket size. It could go in the back of my jeans.
It's designed to go in your pocket, and then you can remove it whenever you need, so in your waistcoat pocket.
And what about this here? Now, this is a looks like a leather-bound.
This is a leather-bound notebook. So leather-bound notebook, just that people would scribble odds and ends in they were on the ship.
So that's just notes to themselves, maybe little observations, and music too.
So the sheet music we've got is actually quite rare. So there's a piece here that belonged to a passenger who was actually going to London to get married. And you have to imagine that he was sat on the ship writing it out, because it's very rough notation.
So he's composing his first dance?
Not quite, but he was writing out tunes from memory. So they're all quite well-known folk tunes. Mm. And he must have been kind of playing them, writing them down so he could play while he was on the ship itself. So we have a lot of things that are kind of the product of boredom.
Okay, so we've seen so much from the things that were pulled out of the Franciscus during the catch by the British. What's your favourite thing that you've come across, Oliver?
I think my favourite thing from this ship is the poetry that was written by one of the passengers while he was on the ship, because He wrote it out really roughly on a small piece of paper, which is covered in his jottings. Yeah.
Ink splatters aplenty. Yeah. And how does he begin this poem that he's so artfully put together?
He begins with the phrase, sweet nymph. I can probably try and find a passage if we got time. How does it go? Sweet nymph, if you would be happy and joyous in heart, would prove come venture out along with me and taste the sweets of love.
Wow. They're just writing this in there.
Yeah, it's terrible poetry.
It's terrible poetry, but it's still your favourite. Because why? Why is it, even though it's...
Because it speaks to this collection. It's not about who was a tremendously important person. Mm. It's not about who wrote a great work of art. It's not about someone else has already made a decision for you that you should be able to see these records hundreds of years later.
Going back to the unmediated nature of the collection.
Exactly. It doesn't have the same level of filter on it. And it means that we can access all of these different lives, which otherwise just become completely forgotten. Most of these papers that we see here are not things that people at the time would have thought were particularly valuable. And in the way that we don't think most of the time that one email or one scrap of paper that we retain is valuable. But because we're never going to know what somebody in hundreds of years is actually going to value, that makes a collection like this tremendous in its potential for what you can do with research. It's research on everyday people, you know, and how they lived in this period. You get a lot about how the world was connected. You also get a lot about the benefits that people derived from that world, also a lot of the problems that came from a more connected world, a lot of the ways in which people struggled as a result of it.
And I guess there's a bit of an assumption that the world is not connected at this time, but these papers alone show us how vastly enmeshed these different worlds are, these different realities.
Mm. So people could travel relatively easily. You've got to think it's not that hard to get on a ship and be gone.
And it also shows us, I guess, how trade operated, the marks for people that were illiterate, and also, I guess, the patterns of empire and the forces moving all of this stuff around the globe.
The way that empires weren't really directed centrally in a very coherent way is the sense that you get from this collection, which is that the sinews of it were maintained by everyday people who are living their lives. And the whole thing was structured by the incentives of trade.
And those people were writing bad poetry aboard a ship at that time.
They were, exactly. Because they thought that nobody would ever see it.
And here we are looking at them. And I wonder then, okay, so we're very privileged to be looking at these things today from the collection. Can people outside of the National Archives look at the prize papers?
They can. So gradually we're working through it. The more that we sort, the more we catalogue, the more that we find, the more becomes available, which is going to until 2038, which is when the project will eventually conclude.
And so it's being digitised.
So you can see it here. You can also, the part of the project is we are digitising it. So we're making everything accessible online. It's completely open access, so it's free to anybody. So you can go to prizepapers.de, which is the website maintained by our partners in Oldenburg, and you can start to look at some of the material we've got up already. We've got about 20,000 documents up there already, but obviously it's about 500,000 documents. So we're just getting started.
And we can also read your reflections in blog posts and things like that, can't we?
Yes, I've got a blog which I've written which recreates the whole story of William Farrell's terrible 4 years, which you can read about. It's on the National Archives website. There's also a case study of the Franciscus that you can find on the Prize Papers website as well.
That's great. Thank you so much for telling us this amazing story of the Franciscus and giving us such a brilliant overview of this vast collection, the Prize Papers. You've hinted a few times at the need for deep expertise in heritage science and conservation in this project, the physical nature of the collection, and I'd like to hear a bit more about that work.
Yeah, I would like to find out more as well about some of the work that goes on with this collection that's more to do with its physical nature, as you say, its materiality. So for this, I think we can talk to two experts that work on the project. The first is Mark Vermeulen, who uses scientific techniques to understand more about the items themselves and where they come from, and Marina Casagrande, who is our project conservator, who works with every sheet of paper that we go through to make sure its condition is appropriate to be digitized and to be preserved for the future.
So can I pass the baton to you and our heritage scientists, Mark and Marina, and they can tell us a little bit more about that process within the project. That's going to be episode 2 in this series. And me, I want to find out how the Prize Papers project can tell us about the global nature of this time and also colonialism and empire. That's going to be episode 3. Thanks for listening to On the Record from the National Archives. To find out more about the National Archives, follow the link from the episode description in your podcast listening app. Visit nationalarchives.gov.uk to subscribe to On the Record at the National Archives so you don't miss new episodes, which are released throughout the year. Listeners, we need your help to make this podcast better. We need to know a bit more about you and what themes you're interested in. You can share this information with us by visiting smartsurvey.co.uk/on the record. That's smartsurvey.co.uk/on the record. We'll include that link in the episode description and on our website. You can also share your feedback or suggestions for future series by emailing us at ontherecord@nationalarchives.gov.uk. Finally, thank you to all our experts who contributed to this episode. This episode was written, edited, and produced by Tash Walker and Adam Smith of Aunt Nell for the National Archives. This podcast from the National Archives is Crown copyright. It is available for reuse under the terms of the Open Government License. You'll hear from us soon,